Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa.Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. I'd like to begin by welcoming everyone who's gathered this evening, this rainy night in the Vyagiri Monastery. This is a weekend of many auspicious events. In Thailand, they often say that when something really special and very blessed occasion is happening, then the skies open up and the rain pours down as a benediction from above. So let's hope that's a good sign from the heavens. And let's also hope that it's there's only so much water in the sky. And it'll all have all come down by tomorrow morning, and we'll have a clear spell for the ceremonies outside tomorrow. Today we had a memorial, a 1 year death anniversary, a memorial for our dear friend and Dhamma companion, Pia Silo, Todd Tansuhat, who was a young boy who was ordained as a novice, as a samanera here for a little while before he undertook a medical treatment. And he was in hospital with a bone marrow transplant for many months, and sadly the treatment didn't work, didn't take, and he passed away April 27th last year. So we're just a few days shy of that anniversary, and I spent a bit of time with him in his last few months up in the hospital in Seattle, and his parents are here, and many of his friends have come down for this occasion, family also. Also, I was very impressed this evening when they were some of the young ones were given the choice of going into town for dinner or staying here at the monastery to hear a Dhamma talk. They wanted Dhamma over dinner, which is when I was 11, there wouldn't have been much of a contest. I freely admit dinner would have won out every time. So this is has been a special day, and reflecting on our young friend Todd and his life. And up here on the shrine, there's some pictures of him when he was as a novice here on my right, and then when he was in the hospital just before he passed away. And so I've been reflecting on him and his life. Also, as I was listening to all the rain coming down during the sitting, I was reminded of a poem I read many years ago, which I was very touched by, that in a way reflected something of my impressions of Todd's life, and also this afternoon when we had a little memorial service, some of the things that people were saying. And this is a very short poem, and it goes, like water unconcerned, does only what it can, unexalted, all-sustaining, brings its gift and passes on. So many of us felt little Todd, unexalted, just a little fella, a cheerful guy, running about, doing his thing, but all-sustaining in that way. He's brought so many gifts, enriched the lives of so many people, and then passed on, just like water running down from the skies, falling onto the ground, fertilizing the spring plants, moistening up the ground, and then running down into the creeks and the streams and flowing off to the sea. So it's a beautiful image, a way to think of a being's life, and just like water, nothing special, but yet totally special, all at the same time. Also, this afternoon we took a beautiful marble casket, very simple marble casket that had been made in Thailand for Todd's ashes, and took it out into the forest, and we made a little nook under the natural curve of a tree root, a great oak tree out in the very heart of the forest, the area called the Cool Oaks, where three of the main streams of the forest all come together, and there's water running, or at least trickling, all year round. And there was a perfectly shaped little nook. We made a space for Todd's ashes to go there. And one of the verses that we chanted, those of us who are out there, will maybe remember the last of the verses that we did. There was a lot of sound of running water, the stream and the rain. But those of you who can remember, began Jayanto Bodhya Mule Sakyanang Nandivadano. And this is called the Jaya Purita, or the protection verses about victory. And it talks about the victory of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment. And so Ajahn Pasano and I were discussing what we ought to do for the little ceremony out there. I said, well, you know, when there's a tree root involved, a Jaya Purita is always good, because it talks about the Buddha sitting at the root of the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment. And thinking about that verse, then thinking, well, what was the Buddha? What was the victory of the Buddha? What was the Buddha victorious over? What was the contest, if you like? According to the Buddhist mythology and Buddhist understanding, we would say it was the Buddha's enlightenment, that complete waking up, the breaking through to a total understanding of the way life is, is represented as a victory over birth and death, a victory over Mara, the lord of death, or the embodiment of death. Now, when we think about this kind of, or use this kind of language, victory over birth and death, this is not something that we kind of normally comes up in conversation, you know, down at the laundromat or in the aisle at Safeways. You know. It sounds a bit remote or difficult. How can that be special? What's that got to do with my life? We think maybe it's got a dramatic, mythological flavor to it. But what makes that so important? Why should this be such a powerful or special thing? So often it's missed when we come across spiritual teachings that they're the main aim of them, and particularly in Buddhist teachings. These are supposed to be ideas and principles, teachings that really help our lives in very direct and practical ways. And so when we take a theme or a principle like victory over birth and death, or the conquest of death, breaking free from that cycle, it's maybe a little more helpful to look at it in terms of our own lives, how we can kind of bring that home. And so it can be the same principle is talking about all of the little ups and downs, the births and deaths of our own life, the times of happiness, the times of sadness, the times of success, the times of failure, the times when of the feeling of being praised, the feeling of being criticized. So if we talk in terms of victory over birth and death, it can seem like some sort of strange mythological tale. But when we talk about dealing with being liked, being disliked, winning, losing, being praised, being criticized, okay, and that's a bit more close to home. We know what that's about. We can relate to that. So when we talk about Buddhist practice, or what we are really aiming to do with living a Buddhist life, or using the Buddha's wisdom in our lives, it's learning how to break free, to have that kind of victory over being pulled around by the ups and downs of life, you know, being swept along by the waves of success and failure, praise and criticism, what the Buddha referred to as the worldly winds of happiness and unhappiness, success and failure, praise and criticism, gain and loss, fame and disrepute. These are the winds that we all get buffeted by. I was reminded today of when I was young, this kind of age of some of the lads here staying at the near the monastery. And even though I've got short, stubby legs, I have very flexible hips. You might wonder why I'm talking about this, but I inherited very flexible hips from my mother. So what this meant was that when I was in high school and we would try out for different things in gym or in the track team and things, I found to my surprise that I was very, even though I got short, short, thick legs, I was very good at the high hurdles. Because my legs were bent very easily, they were very. It was very easy for me to get over the hurdles. You know, I can sprint hurdles. You have a whole line of 8 or 10 hurdles in 100 yards, 80 yards, 120 yard sprint, and they're only 3 paces apart. Because you didn't know. you have 3 paces between each hurdle. And to my surprise, I found I was because I was so flexible, I was really quick over the hurdles. And so whenever we had these races, I always won them. So then they put me in for the local the kind of district championships. And to my amazement, I won the district championships by a street. I was way ahead of everybody. I thought, oh, that was good. You know what winning feels like? Yes, I really like that. This is great, go in the competition and leave everyone in the dust. Oh, this is marvelous. So I won the district championships. I was about, 11 or 12. And then got into the county, the county competition. And then I won the county championships again by quite a good margin. I thought, oh, I'm really hot stuff. This is great. I really like hurdles. Athletics is really great. This is a really important thing. Got really excited about all of this. So then, when you get when you win the county championship, then and you kind of run for the county team, you get a big flash to put on the back of your tracksuit. I don't know what you call it in this country, but like a big sort of banner. So, and of course, the county that I was in only had a very short name, Kent. Just four letters. So that meant the letters on the flash that across the back of your tracksuit were really big. So it was very noticeable from a distance. So I could have this big flash on the back of my tracksuit saying Kent. And there's only 3 or 4 other guys in my high school who were similarly running for the county. So we could sort of strut about and look incredibly special, and pretend that we'd forgotten we got this big sign on our back saying, look at me, I'm special. I run for the county. So it was a big status symbol when I at that time. And so I got very very pleased with myself. And I thought this was a great thing. And then the national championships were coming up. And then I found out, to my horror, that the my county wasn't going to put forward a full team to the national championships, and they weren't going to put out a team of hurdlers for the hurdle races, and so I wasn't going to get to go to the nationals. So I thought, I've been robbed. I'm sure I would have won. You can get pretty deluded. If only I could have raced, I'm sure I would have won. So anyway, I had to wait another year or two. Got up to the next category of the hurdles, intermediate, and I was about 14 this time. And so once again, I did the district championships, and I won those, and I got the county championships, and I won those, and I thought, okay, now we're going to definitely, the intermediates are definitely going to be running in the nationals. So this time I've got a chance. And so that, when you're that kind of age, I guess you don't really see these things coming. But... I do suffer something from a bit of an overinflated estimate of my wonderfulness at times. And so there I was, the national championships, and strutting about with my big sign saying Kent across my back. But of course everyone else has got, Lancashire, Gloucestershire. Everyone's got a big sign on their back with the county that they come from. So it wasn't quite so special as it was at my high school there. But I thought, okay, well, okay, what's and I was also already kind of working out my victory speech and telling everyone what it's like to win, you know, win the nationals when I got back to my school. And so there we are in the first heat, kind of line up at the blocks, and some of these other guys look pretty sporty. Long-legged guys look very kind of fast and serious. And I thought, okay, well, you know, I'm pretty good at this. I know I'm going to outpace them. And lo and behold, who was left in the dust? I think I was second to last. I wasn't absolutely last, but out of the six people in the heat, I think I came fifth. And there I was. I couldn't believe it, coming over the finish line, and all these people way ahead of me. Not even just half a second. They were like way in front. And this feeling of, oh, how could that happen? Something terrible has gone wrong. And there's this feeling of enormous disappointment. And not wanting to tell anybody. How can I go back to the school and not mention where I came, and being knocked out of the first heats? So hope and disappointment. They're partners for each other, aren't they? Those kind of lessons that all of us have. I mean, my particular lesson there was through the realm of races and athletics. But it was kind of a shock to me. I didn't see how much my mind had invested, how important it had become for me to be a winner, and how that was something that was good and real and special. And then the fact of being ordinary, being a loser, that was just so unbearable, so embarrassing. So that the fact that I had this big flash on my back saying Kent, it's like, well, suddenly, well, so what? You know, here amongst all these people, it doesn't mean anything. And besides, I got knocked out of the first heat. I'm just ordinary here. I'm absolutely nothing special. Now, when we begin to look at life, we begin to see that the degree to which we invest in hope becomes the degree to which we're invested in disappointment. Those of you who like mathematics, there's a perfect equation. There's a perfectly balanced equation. But even when you win, even when you do come out on top, then you find it's there's a similar chemistry going on. One of our monks, someone who used to be a monk in this community, well, actually in England, not here at Abayagiri, but he was an American monk. And he was a champion wrestler. And this is Greek, what they call Greek wrestling or Olympic wrestling. This isn't the sort of WWE, World Wrestling Federation, TV wrestling with kind of smoke bombs and rock music and kind of enormous guys with very, very angry looks and lots of makeup. And this is sort of serious, official kind of Olympic-type wrestling. But he was extremely gifted. And so he came from Tennessee, and so he used to wrestle in these championships. And he became the Eastern States champion twice. And so when he was in high school. And I remember when we were monks in Thailand, and he was telling me these stories of going through, again, through these competition after competition, winning and winning and winning, and finally he won the whole championship, became the Eastern States of the United of the US champion. And he felt so good. It was incredible. There he was on the top of the heap. I did it. I won. It's great. And he said it was about 10 minutes of complete happiness, of having won the championship, become the big hero. And he made it after all that training and so many hours and so much hard work. And then he started to notice the other guys out in the audience looking at him saying, next year. Just you wait. Don't look so smug. Just you wait. Next year, I'm going to get you. And so then his delight at victory and success, suddenly it became a fear of, oh, I've got to do it again. Ever had that feeling? Suddenly we have to repeat the same thing and live up to other people's expectations. So that the victory and winning, it was sweet. It was really sweet and perfect and good. But it couldn't sustain itself. It was only sweet for so long. And then it was like, oh dear, now they're going to want to get me. They're going to be, they know I'm the winner, and they're going to be looking out for me in particular. So when we talk about something like victory over birth and death, what we're talking about is learning how to find a place of understanding, a place of peace through all of these cycles that we experience. And it's not just sports, you know, this is to do with every other aspect of our life. You know, when we get hired for a job, yay! And then we find out who we have to work with. And then we think we want promotion. And we suddenly get promoted. Yeah, I'm the office manager. And then, oh gee, I've got to look after these people. And then, why does everyone think I'm supposed to be responsible here? Well, because you're the manager. Oh, that's right. I actually have to be in charge of things, take responsibility. Oh, there's a rider that goes upon it. And things come together and they're successful, they feel so sweet. We get promoted, we fall in love, we get married, it's very sweet and delightful. Then it gets difficult and it gets strained and then turns into hard work, and then it can turn sour. And then in many of our lives, and those things that seem to be so hopeful and so sweet and so beautiful, then can easily turn into sources of bitterness and difficulty. So these are very, very familiar themes for all of us, whether it's in our schoolwork or whether it's in our relationships. And coming into the monastery, you might think, I really want to be a monk. I've got to be a monk. Yeah, this is really important. You know, and tomorrow we have our ordination ceremonies. Anagarika Lee is going forth as a samanera and as a novice, and samanera Titapo going forth as a bhikkhu. And we can, in a similar way, we can take hold of these ideas. Like, oh, this is going to be really great. Yeah, I'm going to become a novice. This is great. Hang up those car keys forever. Don't have to worry about money ever again. This is going to be great. Yeah. And then we realize, after we've made the leap and we've taken on the training of a novice or a monk, that, oh, so I can't just go and help myself anymore. I can't just hop in the car. I've got to find someone else to drive the vehicle. Oh, well, that's inconvenient. Oh, well, I asked for this. when we are unwise, then we just keep going through these cycles of hope and disappointment over and over again. And when we get disappointed, we just look out for the next hope. Oh, well, that one didn't work out. Okay, let's try the next one. Try a different competition, a different job, different relationship, different school, different subject, different monastery, different Buddhist tradition. Go back to the Christians. Join the Hindus. Go back to the synagogue. Go back to England. That's the answer. Go back to Thailand. We never learn. We just keep going from one thing. Well, that didn't work out. Okay, let's try that. Let's try something else. Try something else. So this is what we can look at as like the cycle of birth and death, around and around. One hope, one disappointment, and then another hope, another disappointment. And we never learn that there's a pattern there. We never see that we're not ever finding any kind of contentment or any kind of settledness within ourselves. Never finding any ease. We're just riding on one wave of hope after another, and then not able to deal with disappointment. Well, one of the things that is the most precious and helpful in Buddhist tradition is that we find that if we pay attention, it's often the difficult things, the painful things of life. It's when we are disappointed or we do lose someone that we love, like losing Todd. Or when we get fired from a job, or when a relationship does go sour, or our monastery falls apart, or our faculties fail us, or you come second to last in the first heat of the competition, then those painful experiences, they can teach us a lot. And as strange as it may seem, we often learn better from painful experiences than we do from from pleasant ones, from sweet ones. As our teacher Ajahn Chah used to say, if all you experience is happiness and success, we just go to sleep. We end up snoozing through life. Oftentimes it's only the difficult and painful things that get our attention, and then we wake up. So in the trade, this is called the suffering that leads to the end of suffering. So we don't go out looking for trouble, and we don't go looking for pain and difficulty. We don't deliberately lose races or break up relationships or get ourselves fired or disappoint our friends. But these things happen in their own way, like having this big rainstorm, and we have this ceremony scheduled for out of doors. I don't know how many those of us living in the monastery have accessed AccuWeather. You see these worried looks, these kind of worried monks and novices going to the computer. What's AccuWeather saying now? Looking at the forecast. We don't go out looking for trouble, but trouble comes on its own. And so the trick is learning how to see those painful situations, to know them for what they are, to see that they are an intrinsic part of nature, that life is always this way. There's always difficult and painful things as well as sweet and pleasant and neutral things. And if we're wise, then even when things get difficult or painful, those will help us to learn. We'll find qualities of peacefulness and ease. We'll find qualities of understanding that we wouldn't find if we were just kind of snoozing our way through life, not just depending on the next hope. And when we start to look and examine life, we see that even when things are successful, we see, well, it's only success to a certain degree, because I remember what happened last time. Last time I was a big winner, then it just made people more determined to beat me the next time around. Or that, it was pleasant to win or to be a success, for things to go well, but there was also those difficulties that came along with it. Along with the wedding, you got the responsibility of having to take care of someone. Along with the ordination, then you had all these extra rules you have to keep. Along with the beautiful, fancy new car, then you have to worry about parking it in a place where it's safe and it's not going to get damaged. Or this beautiful new camera, then you have to then sort of carefully put away and make sure it doesn't get bumped or damaged. Aha, there's a downside that goes with every plus. Aha, that's what happened last time, so I should be prepared this time. Similarly, when things get difficult, sometimes they bring gifts with them. Just like just at tea time today, one of the guests staying here, we were talking about how she ended up visiting Thailand. She said, "Oh yeah, that was just a huge disaster, but it was where I met my two masters. So it was a disaster that led to her meeting her two great Dharma masters, two great teachers. So it was a painful disaster, but it brought these great blessings along with it as well." There's a story that I like to tell that comes out of the Tibetan tradition, where it's a tale of a young boy living in a Tibetan village. And his family is very, very poor. And the one thing that the family did have was a mare, a female horse. It was the one precious possession they had. Otherwise they were dirt poor, didn't have a penny, didn't have a single coin to rub together. Very, very poor farmers. And so then one day the horse escaped. She ran away. And so the whole family was distraught. Oh, what are we going to do? Oh, our pony's run away. It was the one precious thing we had. Now she's gone. Now we're really lost. We're hopeless. We have nothing. Absolutely nothing. We're ruined. So mom was crying. Dad was crying. The boy was crying. Granny was crying. But then Granny thought for a moment, well, maybe it's not such a bad thing after all. And they think, how can you say that, Granny? She says, well, you never know. Maybe a bad thing, maybe not. So a few days later, to their great surprise and delight, the mare comes trotting back over the hill, and she's got a stallion in tow as well. She found a boyfriend. Oh, wow! Not only have we got the mare, we've got a stallion. We can breed a whole herd of horses. This is great. Our fortune is made. This is marvelous. This is wonderful. Now we're going to be rich. We can have lots of foals and we'll start a whole herd of horses. This is marvelous. Hooray. And Granny said, well, I wouldn't celebrate just yet because this might not be a good thing. Well, how can you say that? Well, you never know. You never know. Then a little while later, boys being boys, the young son of the family thought, wow, a stallion's a much, much kind of bigger and stronger horse than this little kind of plodding mare that we used to have. And, you know, she's kind of nice and sweet, but she doesn't really go very fast. But that stallion, he looks really big and can move. So I think I'll, instead of riding the mare, I think I'll have a go riding the stallion. Even though Mum and Dad said I shouldn't do that, that it was dangerous. While they're not looking, they're out in the fields, I'll kind of just hop on the back and go for a little bit of a trot, yeah, around the back of the hill. So he hops up on board the stallion and boom! Races off, charging over hill and dale. And then this is really great fun, incredibly fast. Bouncing over, you know, leaping over all of the stone walls and ditches and rocks. And the kid's having a great time. And then suddenly, boom! The horse makes a sudden turn. He comes flying off. Crap! Broken leg. So then other people from the village find the boy kind of lying on the ground. Oh, my leg. Oh, no, my leg. I hurt so much. So they carry him back, round up the stallion, bring him back, and they say, oh, no, this is our only son, and now he's got a broken leg. Who's going to inherit the farm? He's never going to walk properly again. Oh, dear, what are we going to do? We're ruined. And then Grandma said, well, maybe so, but yeah, it's sad that he's got a broken leg, but maybe it's not such a bad thing. Well, how can you say that? Well, you never know. And so the boy's lying there at home. He's got his leg in a splint, kind of sitting there grumbling. Didn't even have any comics to read. This is Tibet, you know. Maybe a few sutras. No comics, no radio, no iPod. So everyone's upset because the boy's got a bad leg, and they think, well, he doesn't look as though it's healing properly, and oh, he's never going to walk again, and he's our only kid, and what's going to happen? This is a terrible thing, you know, we're really ruined now. Grandma says, well, you know, maybe it's not such a bad thing. And then the army comes through and they're recruiting. They're going to war again and says, okay, all the young men over the age of 11 and under 20 have to come with us and join the army. Oh, he can't come. He's got a busted leg. He has to stay at home. Hooray! Then the story goes on and on and on and on and on. In good fortune, bad fortune, you never know. Even a broken leg can be a blessing because he got to stay at home and everybody else got swept off to war. So when we're wise, when we develop wisdom, then we see that there's in any success, we see, well, there's a shadow there. In any failure, we see there's a brightness there. When we hope for something, then we also develop a wariness, we're cautious. And when we're disappointed, then we also see, well, you know, this has got a bitter taste, but maybe there's some goodness here too. We see both sides of the coin. Like our teacher would say, it's like seeing the front and the back of the hand. You know, it has a hand has the front and the back. We get both sides. We don't just get one side of the hand. You get both sides. So this is why we meditate, really. You know, when we sit here silently, with our eyes closed and not speaking to each other, when we meditate, learning this kind of lesson is one of the things that we're aiming to do. Learning to watch the mind as it goes through hope and disappointment, happiness, unhappiness, sadness. It goes through the feelings of sweetness of being praised and the bitterness of being criticized. So when we meditate, what we're doing is we're learning how to watch those feelings. Just as if we're standing back and looking at them from a distance. So we're not trying to wipe the feelings out. We're not trying to just turn ourselves into zombies. Like we're sort of neutralizing the mind, sterilizing the mind so we don't feel or sense or think anything. It's not what we're trying to do with meditation. And sometimes it might look like that from the outside. Yeah, when I talk about not depending on hope, not getting swept along by the feeling of hope, it's not like we're trying to make ourselves feel hopeless. It is not about developing hopelessness. more hope freeness, so that we're freeing the heart from being tied to hoping and being tied to being disappointed. We're able to watch those cycles, the feelings, the moods, as they sweep through. The pleasant, the unpleasant, the beautiful, the ugly, the painful, the delightful. And so that as we train the mind, we can see, well, these are just like waves on the ocean. They're just like patterns in nature. The rain comes and then the storm blows through and then the sky is clear again. You know, the day follows night, night follows day. It's kind of obvious when we think of the weather or we think of the sea. But our minds work in exactly the same ways. So that the more that we learn to meditate, the more that we are able to watch the mind and see, yeah, our mind is just an aspect of nature. Just like the rain and the clouds, just like the sun, the day and the night, just like the tides of the sea. Then we find a tremendous peacefulness in our heart. We find a real ease. You know, tomorrow when we have the ordination ceremonies, whether it's raining or not, one of the things that you'll hear being said, those of you who plan to be here tomorrow, but when the candidates ask for their going forth, when they say sabba dukkha nisarana, relinquish all dissatisfaction, to pass beyond, to abandon all suffering, all difficulty, all dissatisfaction, nibbana sacci karanataya, to realize true peacefulness. This is the purpose of going forth. Please may I go forth. Please will you support my going forth. That's what it's for, to cross beyond all difficulty, to realize true peacefulness. So this is why we meditate. This is why people like Lee and Tanti Thapo ask to go forth, to take these extra steps, these further steps on the Buddhist path of commitment. It's really just to learn this kind of lesson, to find that quality of true serenity of heart, true wisdom, true peacefulness, that enables us to be sensitive to the cycles of life, to know, to understand the cycles of life, and to not be confused by them. So that when we meet with success and pleasure and delight, everything goes well, like, you know, you win the race, hooray, well, okay, it's sweet, but it's just a sweet taste. No need to get drunk on it. And when we lose, when we fail, that things fall apart, we lose those that we love, well, it's bitter, but it's only a bitter taste. No need to fall into a million pieces on account of that. It's a bitter taste, it's a sadness, but it's just a bitter taste. No need to fall apart. And so that we find that there's that peacefulness is a true harmonizing of our life. We find ourselves at one with others, at one with the world, at one with the people who like us, who dislike us, the people we live with, and the world around us. And we find a true quality of independence, so that we can work with the ups and downs of life, we can work with our pleasures and pains, successes and failures, and we can make the best of each situation that we meet with. And so in our heart we find a great contentment, a great happiness, and a great quality of freedom. Nothing can go wrong. Even if it's pouring with rain all day. But we find, okay, well, this is the way it is. And we find that even if everything is not as we would have chosen it, we can find a true ease, a true peacefulness, a true contentment, even with what we didn't choose, because we realize, well, here it is. The world is like this, and I can either make a problem out of it or not. But this is how the world is. And so we find that true quality of peace and ease, and we realize this is the greatest richness in life, the greatest joy, and the greatest gift that the world can bring us. So I offer these words for consideration this evening. Andamayam dhammakathaya sadhukaram dadamase. Sa.